But I want to be an imperial princess who helps you, instead of one who flounces in, acts bratty, and asks you to be her hero whenever anything goes wrong. Isn't Anna in the same boat?
And I'm trying to prevent a demonic invasion from overrunning the Empire, Nathan said.
Great. We both want the same thing. Alice huffed and threw her pen at Nathan. He caught it with one hand. It bounced on top of the pile of reports a moment later.
I already have a lot of things in life. Everybody preaches noblesse oblige, but never follows through. Now I have a chance to do something, and you've spent the past few days running yourself ragged without letting me help, Alice said.
She waved a hand at the paperwork. And this doesn't count. Letters to nobles and mages could be written by anybody. If the job of an emperor was to do paperwork, then you may as well replace us with a random peasant whose job it is to stamp everything in front of him.
Isn't that how it works in the courts? Nathan said, letting a little smugness leak through.
She rolled her eyes and threw her pen at him again. He let it hit him this time, as he probably deserved it.
I said replace us. The courtiers don't make the decisions on war, taxes, or negotiations, she said.
Her hands ran along the pen before she set it down again. Alice stood up and walked around the table to be in front of Nathan.
I have the best education in the Empire, some of the best tutors. Both sides of my family are obscenely wealthy and powerful. If I'm not here to help you protect my homeland and family, what am I here for?
Nathan took one of Alice's hands, and she closed her other around his. She smiled at him. For a moment, Nathan saw a different princess in front of him. He sighed.
I get it.
Good. Alice rubbed his hands. I wish I was able to stay for longer. Charlotte's been terrified since the invasion.
You're heading back to Falmir? Nathan asked.
Nope, she said. Charlotte says she's seen enough to know that what happened in the Diet was posturing, and she thinks the threat of demons and the Cascade is more important than some stupid nationalist insults. I'll take her back to Alaik and report to Grandpa. Then you can bet I'll be coming back here. She prodded him in the chest. Nathan grabbed her hand. In response, Alice gave him a puzzled smile. He wasn't sure how he felt about Alice. He was less sure how she felt about him. For now, he settled things by kissing her hand in the style of chivalrous knights of old. Alice giggled, her face glowing red.
Well, at least I know that I'm your princess, Alice muttered, as she wandered back to Nathan's desk.
That was a statement that Nathan had difficulty processing. He filed it away for later and left the room. 2 days later, communications had largely returned across the eastern border. The worst of it was that Leopold remained gravely injured. His condition had improved enough that he could travel, but neither he nor Nathan had prepared the catalysts for a gateway to one of his fortresses. With the horseless carriages operational again, his champions bundled him into one. Before he left, he sent his champions away from the carriage. Nathan closed the carriage door and sat down. Leopold took a heavy breath, his breathing ragged. His normally clean-shaven chin was now covered in thick stubble.
I know we said there'd be words after the invasion, Leopold said, voice like gravel. That can come later. Right now, I am giving you complete authority over the Imperial Army on the eastern border of the Anfeng Empire.
Nathan's eyebrows shot up. He opened his mouth to say something, but words failed him.
Ha! Didn't expect that? Leopold chuckled, but it turned into a cough.
A triangle of magic flared in Nathan's hands, but Leopold waved him off.
I'm fine. It just hurts to laugh.
Leopold sighed.
Hans and Gortal gave me the power before the negotiations, without informing anyone. They've been worried about Tarbin and what he might pull, so ensured that any Imperial forces couldn't be controlled by any other bastions.
A stubby finger pointed at Nathan's chest and prodded him weakly.
Now it falls to you. We don't know if Tarbin's behind this, but anything could happen next. I trust you. I know that Alice does as well. However you know the things you do, it doesn't matter. Just don't fuck it up.
His eyes bored into Nathan's. Nathan nodded grimly. He watched as Leopold's carriage trundled away. So, the old man had suspected him of knowing too much. Nathan had wondered why his slip-ups had never drawn any attention. The answer was staring him in the face the whole time. Overlooking Nathan's suspicious behavior and background had been to Leopold's political advantage. And it remained to his advantage. Protecting the Empire and denying the Nationalists remained Leopold's highest priority. He was, after all, the right hand of Emperor Gortal, and a man who made many mistakes in the lead-up to the fall of the Anfang Empire in Nathan's timeline. A day later, a much less emotional farewell took place with the two princesses. Alice swept Nathan up in a hug. She wore a dark silk skirt that showed more thigh than Nathan had seen before, and her white socks left a tantalizingly thin amount of skin open. "I'll be back soon," Alice said. "I left a two-way mirror in your office. Talk to me. Anna has one as well." Charlotte gave no farewell and seemed terrified of showing Nathan her face. For some reason, Nathan felt nothing as he watched the meek woman slip into the carriage. He had been pulsing with excitement when he first discovered her presence, and now he struggled to find even the tiniest hint of emotion in his mind. A hand ran along his ass and pulled him from his thoughts. He glared at the dark-skinned elf that pressed her voluptuous breasts against his arm.
"It seems your father's blood does run in your veins. I always doubted it, but you've proven everybody wrong. Or maybe you've proven everybody right."
Nerevia laughed.
"Everybody did say that you were the best son that Tarbin could ever hope to have. Maybe they knew you would bloom. And now your pollen is ripe for the harvest."
Her hands ran along his crotch. Nathan pushed her away, and she stumbled in the dirt for a few steps. Her amethysts glimmered for a moment, and Nathan tensed. Elsewhere in the courtyard, both Faye and Seraph took up aggressive stances. When Nerevia recovered, an ecstatic expression overcame her. She licked her lips and stared at him with glazed-over purple eyes.
"A little weak, but there's definitely hints of Daddy in there," the dark elf purred.
She ran a hand over her stomach where Nathan had pushed her.
"I think the best thing Tarbin ever did was banishing you. I can't wait until we meet again, Nathan."
On the contrary, Nathan wanted to wait as long as possible. He suspected that he would be seeing Nerevia sooner than he would like, unfortunately. Suddenly, the dark elf lunged for him. He reached for his sword, but she stopped short. Her expression turned serious. She stood on her toes and spoke into his ear.
"A word of warning. Falmir isn't all that it seems. Speak to your little wolf butler if you want to know."
Nerevia leaned away and smirked at him.
"Consider that a belated gift in recognition of achieving your manhood."
"I'm over 30, you know."
"Yes, and I'm recognizing you as a man now. Be proud.
Nerevia rose to her full height, leaving as many openings as she could. She was twisted inside and out, Nathan knew. He gave her a light push toward the carriage, and she pouted at him. Despite that, she still rubbed the place that he had pushed her. The castle felt almost empty in the afternoon. Sunstorm was napping after a patrol, and Faye had taken over from her. Seraph had returned to Fort Tobram and taken command of the Eastern Front. With communications restored, Vera preferred the comfort of her tower over Garrick Pass. Anna had countless anxious nobles and merchants to deal with, although she rarely spent more than a night or two away from the castle. Nathan found it odd that Anna appeared to have moved into his fortress, when she constantly talked about renovating and upgrading her family manor. Only Sen was awake. She kept him company in his office, although her unfocused expression made it clear that she was conversing with Ifrit, probably practicing spells or learning new magical theory. A knock sounded on the door, and a wolf girl knight opened it. Her tail wagged when she noticed that Faye wasn't here, her eyes skimming over Sen. Her words were a lot more serious than her reaction implied.
Bastion, our scouts have seen a carriage approaching. Its escorts are carrying the flag of the Aurelian Spires, and the emblems on the carriage are of the Council of Aurelia, the knight said.
A carriage sent by the Council meant only one thing. The notoriously anti-human spires had sent a diplomatic envoy to speak to Nathan. Chapter 26. Nathan waited for the dark elves in his office. He had dealt with them before, and knew that he needed to handle the envoy with care. The Aurelian Spires were an ancient city-state that sat at the heart of Domar. The city loomed over Forzel Valley and was built into the northern half of the Garrick Mountains. Scholars believed that the ancient sandstone spires had been built by the First Peoples, which was the name given to the fairies of old. Modern fairies didn't deserve such an important name, even if they still referred to themselves using it. This wasn't prejudice to Nathan. Something had changed in the fairies at some point. The First Peoples had built the system of cairns across Domar, mapped out the ley lines, and established the entire system of bastions. While it was frowned upon to admit as much, they had been the Watcher Omria's favored ones well before the Anfeng Empire existed. Then something happened. Omria moved on, and the fairies became less important. Most history from before the Anfeng Empire was based on archaeological evidence rather than written record, so nothing was certain. But the fact that nobody recorded what happened between Omria and the fairies remained cause for concern, particularly given her disappearance. The empire was ancient, millennia old, but the spires and cairns were older still. Had Omria abandoned the First Peoples and moved on to humanity? Was history repeating? Was that why she had disappeared over 400 years ago? Nathan didn't know. Nobody did. Even timeless spirits such as Ifrit refused to speak about her. For whatever reason, Kadria clammed up when it came to Omria. In the end, the origins of the spires remained a mystery, as did Omria herself. What wasn't a mystery was how the spires came into the possession of the Dark Elves. The declining power of the fairies allowed their servants to overthrow them, and the Dark Elves claimed the shining jewel of the Fey Kingdom. Between the rise of humanity in the West and the rebellion of the Dark Elves, the fairies were pushed east. There, the fairies founded the Republic of Arcadia, although not until they had butchered each other for a good 1,000 or so years in a brutal civil war. The fields of Arcadia were steeped so heavily in blood that there were folk tales about it. Some even suggested that the productivity of their fields was due to how many dead fairies there were in the ground. These days, Arcadia was considered something of a paradise,
an idyllic natural habitat of beautiful lakes, forest, and grasslands. At least, so long as you were a fairy. The spires weren't much different to Arcadia. The Dark Elves were originally a nocturnal race that lived underground. The fairies had enslaved them and used them as laborers, taking advantage of their impressive magic prowess. Both surface-dwelling and subterranean elves were the most powerful magic-using mortal races on Domar, save for the fairies and mystic foxes. But where the surface elves were pacifists and abhorred violence, the Dark Elves soaked up the teachings of their masters like a sponge did dirty water. The culture within the spires encouraged public humiliation, physical punishment, open hatred of non-Dark Elves, and diplomatic isolation. Nathan firmly believed that the only thing that stopped the Dark Elves from attempting to conquer Domar was their strong dislike of sunlight. While millennia of adaptation had changed them, the average Dark Elf preferred to spend all day curled up in a squat hole in a rat's nest of a city, rather than face the sun for an hour. The insane sprawl of the spires wasn't due to poverty or an outright dislike of the people who lived there. It was the most desirable way for Dark Elves to live on the surface. Dark Elves who didn't mind the sun, like Nerevia, had spent most of their lives denying their natural preferences. Champions, bastions, merchants, and diplomats were groomed from birth to withstand long days in the sun, which made the approaching diplomatic envoy all the more significant. The Dark Elves never reached out to other races. Nathan knew this from experience. The Empire had collapsed. Arcadia had been in the midst of another civil war, and the Federation was in the grips of Tanius's madness, and they still had required Charlotte to publicly embarrass herself in front of the Council. Nathan fiddled with the mirror that Alice had left behind while he waited. It was a small hand mirror. Alice had inscribed her name on the back. It seemed familiar somehow, although he couldn't place why. As tempting as it was to contact her using the mirror and possibly even include her in this meeting, he ignored the urge. For one, she was likely still traveling with Charlotte. Nerevia's warning rung in his mind. He also suspected the Dark Elves wanted to speak with him alone. The fact that they arrived within hours of Alice's carriage leaving was suspicious. And why weren't they contacting him ahead of time? Why not contact the Emperor, or Archduke von Milgar? The door swung open. Nobody had knocked. Nathan placed the mirror on top of the desk, reflective side down. A pair of Dark Elves strode in, one male, one female. Behind them, Sen and the Wolf Girl Knight from earlier glared daggers into the backs of the visitors. A red garnet shimmered in the woman's collarbone. Like most Dark Elves, she dressed conservatively. The only skin she showed was above her neck, and a small sliver in the cutout around her gem. Her face was unfamiliar to Nathan, which was unsurprising, given she was a monogem champion. She gave him a haughty look and gestured for him to rise from his seat. The man was familiar, however. He had spoken with Charlotte several times. His name escaped Nathan. What Nathan did remember was that he was a diplomat who specialized in dealing with humans. Nerevia had disliked him, but he had seemed reasonable enough, even if he played the same games as most Dark Elves. His skin was the color of ash, and he wore a tailored silk suit that was almost the same color. Unlike most Dark Elves, both of them wore no visible piercings. Nerevia had been the same, at least when clothed. This was deliberate. Although ostentatious shows of jewelry and faces covered in piercings were a sign of wealth and prosperity for Dark Elves, they knew that the same didn't hold in other cultures. Champions, bastions, and diplomats refrained from visible piercings in order to appeal to non-Dark Elf preferences. The diplomat raised an eyebrow when Nathan remained seated. The corner of his mouth turned upward ever so slightly, and his black eyes narrowed.
"Bastion Nathan Straub, I assume," the diplomat said.
He tilted his head in acknowledgement, but refused to bow.
"I am Suri van Jormun."
He paused.
As you are of noble origin yourself, I assume I don't need to explain my origins.
His eyes bore into Nathan's.
Ah, yes, the if you don't know dark elf culture, you are lesser attitude. Diplomacy with dark elves was all about posturing. Nathan refused to stand, not because he was being impolite, but because it would be taken as a sign of weakness. Sariv was asserting dominance, despite being an uninvited guest from a nation that wasn't in the good graces of the Empire. Every inch that Nathan gave out of politeness would be returned with a sneer and an attempt to claim moral superiority.
You are Sariv from the Yorman Spire, Nathan said flatly. It's the central spire where the Council of Aurelia conducts its business. I'd say I'm honored to host such a prestigious guest, but I'm a military man in service to my emperor, and I don't have the foggiest clue why you're here.
The dark elf champion's eyes nearly shot out of her head. She took a step forward. To Nathan's surprise, Sariv laughed. Not a chuckle, but a deep-throated laugh that bounced off the walls.
Leave us, Sariv said to his champion.
Honored envoy, I,
the champion began to say. Sariv's face hardened, and the champion swallowed her words. She pushed her way past Sen and the wolf girl without a backward glance. After a long look at Nathan, Sen closed the door and left Nathan alone with Sariv. Several long moments passed before Sariv turned to face the door.
This room is warded, I assume? He asked. Would a bastion conduct business in a room that isn't?
A smart one wouldn't.
It is fortunate that my first impression of you is as positive as my spies told me it would be.
Sariv pulled out a chair and took a seat.
Normally I would keep the charade going, but I am here to conduct important business on behalf of the Council. Angering you does not behoove me.
And here I thought angering humans was the Dark Elf national sport, Nathan said.
It is, but sport is played in public. We are most decidedly not in public.
The Dark Elf waved a hand toward the cabinets and shelves behind Nathan.
Is there any possibility of a drink?
After a moment of thought, Nathan rose. Any preference?
A local lager would be nice. I can drink aged wine and spirits at my leisure in the spires, but Yuanfeng brews some delightful regional beer at this time of year. It's a guilty pleasure of mine when I visit Aleik during winter.
There weren't any kegs in Nathan's office. He doubted whether anybody kept kegs of beer in their office. Was this a test by Sariv to see if the servants were listening and would turn up in moments with beer to prevent Nathan from being embarrassed? Was that even something that might happen with nobility and the spires? Nathan genuinely had no clue, although he certainly had memories of servants turning up suspiciously quickly with drinks and food after they were requested. Whatever Sariv's intentions, Nathan had no such intelligence network of servants to spy on his needs. Nathan walked over to the door and opened it. Sen and the Dark Elf Champion were outside, glaring at one another.
Sen, have the servants bring a jug of lager and some ceremonial steins, Nathan said.
She blinked at him. He didn't wait to see her reaction before closing the door.
It'll be here in a few minutes, Nathan said.
Sariv chuckled. And here I thought you'd keep it on tap in your office. Wouldn't a network of pipes and a brewery be simple for you?
Absolutely not. Shipping in the raw material would be a nightmare, and the pipes would play havoc with the wards. How could I ward the office if I intentionally put a hole in it? Nathan shook his head.
Create the material here, then, Sariv suggested.
Then the beer tastes terrible. Even with processing, magically created food and drink is flavorless garbage. I'd be better off riding into a random village and drinking whatever they've brewed, Nathan said.
I hadn't thought that you couldn't salvage the end product.
But I suppose I'm not the Bastion, Cerive shrugged.
Nathan wasn't sure what to make of the man in front of him. His memories suggested that Cerive wasn't to be entirely trusted, but the attitude on show was different from the one shown in Nathan's timeline. Had Nathan impressed the council that much? Or had Charlotte been that unimpressive?
"Do you really care that much that I knew what your name meant?" Nathan asked, leaning on his desk with his arms folded.
"No, but everything adds up."
Cerive leaned forward, his eyes gleaming.
"A Bastion who was exiled by his imperialist father for harboring pro-beastkin tendencies is of interest. When that same Bastion thwarts an invasion by the Federation and wins the backing of Leopold Tyrim, he becomes a man to watch closely. Stealing two champions from another Bastion, winning a string of victories, and making well-founded accusations of heresy against one of the most powerful and ambitious men on Domar?
I get your point. I'm standing out," Nathan said.
"You're a radiant beacon of glory," Cerive corrected, "and one that the Council wishes to work with. That's not an honor offered lightly."
There was a knock at the door, saving Nathan the need to respond to Cerive's words. A maid brought in a tray with a massive metal container and two blown glass steins. Unlike King George's gargantuan stein, these were only the size of an ordinary tankard. Engraved into the glasses were intricate images of Omria, interweaved with emblems of the Empire. When they were alone again, Cerive poured a tall, foamy glass of the pale beer. He took a long draught and nodded approvingly.
"I've missed this," the Dark Elf said. "Now, to business. I don't need to tell you that things have gone awry recently."
"There was a tiny cascade, yes."
Cerive's smile dimmed slightly.
"Yes, and that is our business. What do you make of the current situation at the Spires?"
"You're assuming I know?" Nathan asked.
"You'll be considerably less useful to the Council if you don't."
Nathan wasn't even sure what was happening now, but he decided to play along.
"There aren't any demons running around Forzel Valley, so if the city is in lockdown by the army, that means the Council wants to keep somebody in, or somebody out."
"Oh? You're not worried that we're concerned about an imminent assault by land? Hasn't that been your concern?"
Cerive smirked. Nathan scoffed.
"The Federation lacks the power to threaten the Spires. Arcadia would fall to pieces internally if it attempted to use its army. And I can't imagine any reason the Empire or Trafome would attack the Spires. Who else would attack you by land? The far reaches are practically uninhabited."
"A curious opinion about Arcadia," the Dark Elf said.
He drained his glass and poured another. The map across the table drew his attention. Or, more accurately, he made an obvious show of looking at it.
"But yes, you're correct. The cascade has alarmed the Council. It should not have happened. The portals within the Spires have been active for longer than any Dark Elf is aware of, and a messenger could arrive at any time. The fact one was closed during an invasion without the Council's approval, or that of any of the three Bastions responsible for each of them, is deeply concerning."
"And?" Nathan asked.
"And the Council will not allow such heresy to stand. The safety of the city is threatened, and that of our entire race. I trust you understand our feelings."
Cerive's expression hardened. His fingers traced the border with the Federation. From Nathan's experience, the Council had never really cared about heresy, or even the safety of the Spires. This was about the power of the Council. Somebody had deceived the most powerful Dark Elves on Domar,
and they were furious. Nobody held a grudge like a politician betrayed. You're here to cut a deal, Nathan said. He took a seat and finally drank his own beer.
I am. I trust you can keep this matter private.
I am a bastion of the Emperor, Nathan reminded Sarive.
Not that private, the dark elf chuckled. But chattering nobles do not need to know how nations are truly run, do they?
Sarive's fingers found the center of the Federation, and he tapped one city in particular.
Our objectives align, I believe. The Council wants you to bring us High Lord Tonius, so that he can be tried for the crime of heresy against the Aurelian spires and the Dark Elf people. You want him gone as well, do you not?
Nathan leaned back in his chair. This was a turn of events he hadn't anticipated. But Tonius losing his allies only accelerated history. It didn't help Nathan.
What does the Empire gain from this?
In case you haven't noticed, we've been trying to end the war with the Federation, Nathan said. I doubt the Emperor will be happy to hand over the catalyst for the war to a foreign nation, unless there's something to gain.
Of course. You want peace and stability. So do we. As such, the Council will support the Empire's claim to the Federation's territory in return for Tonius. There would also be some additional treaties required, particularly for trade and guaranteeing the defensive line along the Hakim Desert, but the offer is decisive.
Had Nathan heard that correctly?
Define support, Nathan said, trying to keep his voice steady.
Diplomatic and military. As I said, we want stability. Do you think the Federation can remain stable in its current state? Do you think it can hold off the demons swarming across its eastern border?
Sarive sneered.
Nobody wants another Kurai. Tonius has made his bed, but there is no reason we should lay in it with him.
Afterward, there was little else to discuss. Nathan gifted the diplomat a small keg of lager to take with him, and arranged for another meeting in the near future. Conquering a foreign nation wasn't a decision to be taken lightly. Nathan needed at least a few days to think on it, and to figure out who to involve. On the surface, he claimed he would involve the Imperial family. In truth, he wasn't sure what to do. Nathan knew nothing about Emperor Gortal or Archduke von Milgar. Leopold was incapacitated and had left him with the authority to do what he felt was necessary. That left Anna and Alice. One of them was still traveling and would be unavailable for a little longer. Nathan promised himself that he would contact her using the mirror tonight, even if it was only to organize a time they could talk in private. But Anna would be returning to the fortress this afternoon. Nathan already knew what he wanted to do when it came to Tonius, but he couldn't help but wonder if he was falling into a trap. The Dark Elves had never been so proactive before. Whatever the case, Nathan needed to decide soon. The end of winter approached.
Chapter 27.
I'm guessing that was a fairly heavy meeting, Sen said. I don't think I've ever seen you run away from your office that fast.
Thank you for saying that I ran away, Nathan said dryly.
I call it like I see it.
Sen tried to smirk, but her expression was too serious for it to work.
What even happened in there, Nathan?
Politics, mostly. And an offer I didn't expect to be made in 1,000 years, Nathan said. The two of them walked along the battlements of the inner wall of Garrick Pass. Spring had nearly arrived, and the only snow was visible within the nearby mountain line itself. Slush and mountain covered the hills and ran along the ditches. Nathan's soldiers had dug small streams to redirect any runoff away from the fortress and the pass. Most of these streams bubbled with water, and a small lake had formed south of the fortress. Buds formed on the trees as the local flora prepared for warmer weather. It would be weeks before the mountains were warm enough that the Garrick Mountains were safely traversable by large convoys or an army. But for everybody else, spring was effectively here.
"I'd never seen a dark elf before that weird one who came with the princess," Sen said.
She made a funny face.
"Her name was Nerevia, right? I feel some odd emotions about her, and not the most positive ones."
"That's unsurprising. She preyed on weakness, but also wanted others to exploit her weakness." Nathan sighed and ran a hand through his hair. Was talking about the old Sen really a smart idea?
"Weakness, huh? I get the feeling I was weak. Is that the difference between me and who I used to be?" Sen asked.
Exactly the sort of question Nathan didn't want to talk about now. He looked Sen in the eye and realized that she deserved the answer, even if he felt uncomfortable giving it. "Mostly, yes. You have access to the same power that you once had, but the difference is that you didn't have to pay the horrific price for it." Nathan paused, choosing his words carefully. "Even after you joined me, there was still pain. That's what it means to live in a dying world."
"Yeah, I get that feeling. So often I wake up, realize where I am, and just feel this endless sense of relief. I can wander a forest without worrying that a band of demons will ambush me. Everybody I care about is still alive, at least those that matter to me right now. Every day feels almost relaxing, even though I know we're preparing for war. Ifrit chews me out about it, but I find it really hard to get sucked into the doom and gloom feel when I know how much worse things can be."
Sen's eyes gazed over the edge of the wall, as if they were gazing into an abyss. Nathan placed a hand on her shoulder, and she smiled up at him.
"And that's why I'm worried about you," Sen said. "You look a little lost right now."
"I am a little lost right now," Nathan admitted. Letting out a sigh, Nathan bent over and leaned against the edge of the wall. It was cold. He felt the chill seep through his officer's jacket and into his arms, but ignored it. Right now, that feeling helped calm him down. It was the same as pummeling his back with hot water in a shower to focus his thoughts, or pinching his wrist to distract himself. A strong physical sensation to keep him focused on something real, instead of the endless whirlpool of thoughts in his head.
"Oh," Sen said.
She remained silent after that. Unlike him, she leaned her back against the wall. Her red coat was thicker than his jacket. At some point over winter, she had lined it with fur from wolves she had hunted in the mountains. Minutes passed. "You don't have to stay with me, you know," Nathan said. Sen hit him in the side. He glanced at her with a raised eyebrow.
"You realize that I love you, right?" she said, glaring at him. "That I don't stay with you just because of the cool magic lessons or that you're great in bed."
"You're saying I'm not great in bed?" Nathan said.
"Well, it's been a little harder this week since you got a mysterious package upgrade, meaning we haven't been able to do some of the things we usually do."
Sen leered at him, but her expression quickly returned to concern.
"But that's not what I meant. Don't dodge my point."
"I love you too, Sen. I'm just saying that you don't need to hang around in the cold while I think about things."
"You mean while you mope?" she teased.
A few moments passed, her attempt at humor falling flat. She sighed, and Nathan felt her hand on top of his head. Why did his girls feel the need to try to pat his head when they wanted to comfort him? Was it a need to get back at him for constantly patting their heads?
"I don't know how to help you now, besides being by your side. Politics is way beyond me. I'm struggling with the crazy magic stuff you and Ifrit are teaching me."
Sen cleared her throat.
"But, maybe somebody else can help you?"
A few moments passed, and the hand on top of Nathan's head grew noticeably warmer. As in, warm enough that he worried Sen was casting a spell. Nathan looked over at her, then relaxed.
Oh, it's you, Ifrit, Nathan said. It's been a while.
Indeed, a much deeper tone said. It sounded like Sen, if she swallowed a bucket full of gravel, lit her throat on fire, and aged 20 years. Not quite masculine, so much as a very throaty and deep version of Sen's voice, with an edge of fire to it. Ifrit had taken control of Sen's body, and the effect was noticeable. He stood differently, back straight, shoulders wide, no slouch, and hands behind his back. His expression was odd on Sen's face, as it tried to appear both inquisitive and suspicious at the same time. But Sen was a young woman, so it mostly made her look silly.
Is talking to me your idea or Sen's? Nathan asked.
Both. You've been troubled lately, and the events of the Cascade bothered me. Ifrit smiled at Nathan, using Sen's body. A chat would be nice, regardless. While this troublesome child keeps me entertained, I do appreciate talking to somebody else from time to time.
Fair.
Nathan fell silent. Moments passed. This is the part where you talk about your problem or problems, Ifrit said. You're doing a great job coaxing me into feeling secure and comfortable talking about my deepest, darkest issues, Nathan drawled. I have lived too long to spend my time playing psychiatrist, and I can tell that you have issues that you want to talk about, but don't, because people will not understand. So, out with them, Ifrit said. He waved Sen's hand in the air in a circular motion, gesturing for Nathan to get on with it. The air grew warmer around them due to Ifrit's presence. Even through Sen, the spirit's power could be felt simply by proximity. Nathan no longer felt the chill of the wall in his arms. He leaned away from the wall and faced Ifrit.
Have you ever wondered if the things you do have no impact on the world? That everything would play out the same, even if you did nothing?
Ifrit raised an eyebrow. That's an odd statement for a bastion with your status and power to make. Few people can say they've influenced Domar as much as you have in so little time. Isn't that why the Dark Elves came to you?
But does it matter in the end? Nathan said, frustration leaking into his voice.
No answer. After a few moments, Nathan turned away.
Ifrit, do you believe in predetermined events?
A harsh intake of breath, followed by a long silence.
I had my suspicions. There are few ways to traverse timelines, and fewer still to alter memories. You showed limited promise in both, given your knowledge of spatial and mental magic. Even so, I find it difficult to believe that you would speak of this topic without external interference.
Nathan shifted uncomfortably, unwilling to look at Ifrit.
Do not worry. I've cut off Sen's senses for the time being. I assume there is good reason you have left her unaware of your involvement with the messengers, Ifrit said.
Damn, so he did know. At least, he did now.
It's not something I want to burden any of my champions with, Nathan said, looking at Ifrit.
A smart decision, although I hope it's one you made voluntarily.
Ifrit's gaze was as sharp as his words. He moved on and said,
Tell me, what do you mean by predetermined events? Because the way you've described them is slightly different to how I would.
Nathan frowned.
It feels like my actions don't have any real effect on the world. If I stop something from happening, then it simply happens in a slightly different way.
He stopped, realizing he was about to repeat himself.
Maybe an example will help.
Ifrit gestured for him to go ahead.
Let's say a town is about to be crushed by a giant boulder.
This happens, but I survive and go back in time to stop it, Nathan explained.
For some reason, Ifrit's eyes narrowed at the mention of going back in time. Nathan didn't question this, but he filed it away for later. Continuing, Nathan said,
I know about the boulder, so I gather up my friends in the past and stop it.
But the boulder returns to its position, Ifrit offered. Or perhaps another town is threatened by the boulder.
Not quite. Nathan shook his head. It's more like another boulder appears. I know how to stop boulders from crushing towns, so I can stop it. But every time I do, another boulder appears. And another. Eventually, it becomes clear that no matter how many times I save the town, another boulder will appear to destroy it. Nothing I do can change the future. And if that's the case, does anything I do actually matter?
Ah, Ifrit said, closing his eyes.
After a few moments, he gestured for Nathan to walk with him. They walked along the battlements. A couple of guards gave Ifrit odd looks, probably because Sen doesn't walk like an old man, with her hands behind her back and a thoughtful expression on her face.
What you're talking about is predetermination, Ifrit said.
I know that word, but I don't know what it means, Nathan admitted.
Predetermination is the idea that the future is fixed, that free will does not truly exist, and that the fate of the world is inscribed into our very beings. It is the idea that your actions are decided in advance.
Ifrit paused.
Imagine that you approach a fork in the road, but while there appear to be many options, you can only take one. Maybe it appears that you can choose, but no matter what decision you make, eventually you end up taking the correct road.
The idea chilled Nathan to his core. That sounds a lot like what I'm experiencing, Nathan said. I've been trying to stop the Federation and Empire from going to war since I arrived, but nothing works. I stopped the demonic invasion that triggered it all, but the Federation attacked anyway. I counterattacked and won, but they refused peace negotiations. Then, even when we negotiated, they still pushed back and tried for war. They triggered the cascade to bring down the Empire. And after all of that failed, the spires come out of nowhere and tell me to conquer the Federation.
Nathan laughed bitterly. He had wasted an entire winter trying to stop a war, only to be made an offer to restart it. And that offer came from the last nation he ever expected to side with the Empire.
And what makes that predetermined? Ifrit said.
What? Nathan asked, freezing in place.
You've been confused by your messenger, and I doubt she wants to correct your confusion, Ifrit said. But what you're describing is simply how reality works. There's a common link behind everything you've described, and it doesn't require a higher power to deny you free will.
Nathan frowned. A common link. Obviously, that was Tanius. Probably. Nathan wasn't as certain as the Dark Elves were that the scheming regent was behind the cascade. How could Tanius trigger a demonic invasion and then convince Sebastian or Champion to close a demonic portal?
Regardless, Nathan said, you're talking about Tanius.
I am. You're trying to stop a war, but the main driving force still holds the power to cause it. What makes you think the war would stop simply because you stopped a single trigger?
Ifrit asked. A lot of things had to happen at once to threaten the Empire, Nathan said. And he trailed off. What was this about anymore?
Originally, he had wanted to stop the fall of the Empire in order to prevent the end of Domar. Afterward, Kadria had told him that the war he stopped would continue trying to happen because that was the nature of the world. But his true objective was to stop the demons from overtaking the world. Stopping wars between nations was less important. A war between two countries wasn't guaranteed to result in the end of the world. In fact, Nathan had arguably prevented that from happening. Leopold had even pointed out that the open aggression between the Federation and Empire prevented the cascade from being worse. Even if the Federation and Empire went to war, it was possible that both sides fought in a bloody stalemate that led nowhere. The same was happening in the North against Trafome.
"I've fucked up," Nathan said. He wanted to slap himself in the face.
Ifrit chuckled.
"It is a common mistake that people make. History is often written to make it appear that it happens through a set of amazing coincidences. But the truth is that there are usually many determined people behind the scenes. Events don't happen because of fate. They happen because of the actions of many people, or through the greater will of humanity."
"Things have gotten worse, though," Nathan muttered. "If the war had happened normally, I could ignore it. But now," he sighed, "I've weakened Tanius's hold over the Federation. Even if he remained in power, the other regents will turn on him, eventually. It could result in a vicious civil war. If that happened, that may be the hole in the world that allows a demonic messenger through. The Hakim Desert is a persistent threat, after all."
"And what do you plan to do about it, now that you have wised up to your past mistakes?"
Ifrit asked. Nathan opened his mouth, prepared to make a decisive answer. Then he closed it and thought for a few more moments.
"I think I might talk to Anna first, and maybe Alice as well. I did imply that I'd ask for help if necessary," Nathan said.
"And now you really are wising up."
Ifrit clapped Nathan on the back. It felt odd, given he was in Sen's body.
"I feel like I'm not as old as I think I am," Nathan said. "Although I look back at my past self and think, what an idiot," with regularity.
"That feeling never goes away. I look back at myself from only a year ago and question why I agreed to this possession," Ifrit said dryly. "I did have a favor to ask before I return this body to Sen, however."
"Shoot."
Ifrit fixed Nathan with a strong glare.
"Whenever Sen has magic lessons planned for the next day, please restrain yourself from anal sex. You have no idea how deeply uncomfortable it is to take over her body and provide physical demonstrations for her."
There was a long pause. Nathan cracked a smile, then shook his head.
"You let Sen hear that, didn't you? I suppose you're right that we never stop calling our past selves an idiot."
A scream erupted from Sen's body a moment later. It sounded a lot like Sen rather than Ifrit, probably because it was Sen.
"That asshole!" she shouted. "How dare he say that out loud? I even made him promise to not peek on us when we have sex. How does he even know when we do that stuff?"
Nathan imagined there might have been some clues, if Ifrit was taking over control of Sen's body. Also, Sen didn't exactly shy away from talking or thinking about sex. But Nathan wisely kept his opinion to himself, as his little spellblade raged around the battlements, shouting at the top of her lungs. Suddenly, Sen grabbed Nathan's jacket by the lapel and said,
"We have time before Anna arrives, right? I want to teach him a lesson."
Nathan stared at Sen as it slowly dawned on him what Sen meant.
"Maybe tonight. Anna will be here in less than an hour."
Sen grit her teeth, but let Nathan go. She grumbled to herself and stormed off. Straightening his jacket, Nathan pretended that hadn't happened. No, that was a lie. He admitted to himself that the docile, meek Sen from his timeline was never coming back. This Sen was entirely her own person, and he loved her for it. Tonight would be a lot of fun. But for now, he had a noblewoman to talk to. Two, even. Chapter 28. Narime. A comb ran through Narime's tails. She repeated the motion, carefully covering every inch of the massive bundles of fur that extended from her backside. The process was repetitive, but one that Narime was familiar with. She had, after all, been combing her tails daily for over 300 years now. Within a few winters she would have a seventh tail, and her daily ritual would be even longer. Sometimes she wished somebody else combed her tails for her, but that would mean allowing somebody else to touch some of the most important and sensitive parts of her body. A mystic fox's tails were sacred to them, pure. While Narime had certainly enjoyed herself as a woman before, she never allowed others to despoil her tails. But she still dreamed about a life where this daily ritual involved another person. She could lay back and moan while his fingers ran through her fur, and he ensured that she looked her best. The idea that someone else cared enough about her to take care of her tickled her heart. Then she reminded herself it was a dream. These days, it was a dream with a particular person in them. She disliked that fact because she knew that man wasn't going to be hers. He belonged to a foreign nation, and their interests didn't align. Even so, she dreamed. Right now, she imagined that the hand guiding the comb belonged to him, and let her mind drift away. Voices shouted outside her room. She paused, then decided to ignore them. This happened from time to time in the villa. After the cascade, Narime had decided to remain with Duke Tereus. She had spoken with her bastion, Ariat, and they had come to an agreement that her place was on the frontier against the Empire. Some sharp words were said between them about her role regarding the negotiations, but he hadn't ordered her to return. She took that as a win. Although she was less certain of her past decisions right now, given the Federation's weakening position. War approached rapidly, and the Regency Council was fragmenting every time she spoke to Tereus. For the time being, she remained with the Regent, both to protect him and because he was the only Regent she was on good terms with. Ariat was permanently deployed to the Hakim Desert, and therefore belonged to the Regency Council as a whole. But if push came to shove, Narime suspected he would side with Tanius. It bothered Narime that this was what everything had come down to. Tanius against every other regent. What an absurd situation. The shouting grew closer. This was not normal. She continued to comb her tails. Just in case, she readied her a supercharged fourth-rank spell. A pair of squares glowed menacingly around her hands. The door to her room slammed open. The shouting of the beastkin maids erupted in full volume. Narime glanced up, eyes narrowed. "I've found you," Fias growled. The brute of a bastion took a step into the room, then froze when Narime raised a glowing hand.
"I don't take kindly to threats," Narime said. "And I don't believe you have any right to be here."
Behind Fias came his favorite duo gem champion, Lucia. She held her battle axe over one shoulder and flicked her black pigtails with her spare hand, which made the pink highlights in her hair more obvious.
"We're here on behalf of the Regency Council. You're wanted for treason against the Federation. You're a good mutt, aren't you, Narime? Why not be a good girl and roll over for us?" Lucia said with a smile.
Her amethysts glowed as she prepared to use her enhancements. Narime rolled her eyes at the provocation and dog jokes. Did this idiot really believe she had the advantage because she was in melee range? If this was the quality of the Federation's champions, then Nathan was going to walk all over them. Narime had been shocked at the depth of his tactical understanding of gems, magic, and champions. No bastion in the Federation was even thinking about spatial or mental magic. Narime was practically invincible here, but she wondered what tricks Nathan had up his sleeve if she ever fought him.
"Well, are you going to surrender?" Lucia asked, impatience leaking into her voice.
She refused to take a step closer.
Have I released my spell? Narime asked, her hands still glowing. As I said, you don't have any right to be here.
Fius found his voice and said, As Lucia said, the Regency Council has...
If that is the case, then why don't we go talk to Duke Terius right now?
Narime interrupted. Fius's face paled. His eyes narrowed.
You would waste the time of a regent that you don't serve? Tanius really has broken you in, hasn't he?
Narime wanted to smirk, but pitied him too much. Lucia quivered with rage and raised her axe. Before she did anything rash, Fius grabbed her. Narime strode past both of them and out of the villa. The maid scattered, watching from behind cracks in the doors.
Terius will have your head if you waste his time,
Fius shouted after Narime as he ran after her. She ignored him. The villa sat on an adjacent block to Terius's manor and was part of his estate. Narime wondered how Fius had gotten in. Probably by force. Guards patrolled the exterior of both the manor's gate and the estate, but they were only human. Lucia had already been threatening Narime. Would she even care about a mere guard? The guards outside the gate stared at Narime as she approached. They recognized her, but not Lucia and Fius. Even so, the guards let them in. Somebody ducked inside the manor as Narime walked along the stone pathway. Moments later, a familiar duo gem champion stepped out to greet them. She had blonde horse ears, a long, silky tail, and wore the uniform of Terius's private military. Her hand rested on the hilt of a curved sword at her waist. Its blade was bare and had a stronger curve than typical scimitars. Narime needed a few moments to recognize the woman. This was the horse beastkin champion that had commanded the nearby castle during the invasion. Terius must have moved her to his manor. Tensions had been increasing, and his safety was of increasing concern. While Narime had offered to stay nearby, he had refused. She was, after all, a champion loyal to a bastion that didn't serve him. But if this horse girl was Terius's choice of a bodyguard, Narime wasn't certain that Terius was safe. Narime remembered the look of hatred that the beastkin had given Terius earlier, and the fear when she had realized that Narime was present. Narime, the horse girl said, her eyes washing over Fius and Lucia. What are you here for?
We need to confirm something with Duke Terius. It shouldn't take long, Narime said, feeling that it was best to keep the details from this woman.
His grace is busy. I'll let him know you are here with guests, and he'll be with you once he is finished, the horse girl said. You can wait inside.
She stepped into the manor. Narime followed, Fius grumbling behind her. Shortly, they heard muffled voices in the distance. Narime couldn't make out the words, and a quick scan with her magical senses confirmed that the room was warded. But she recognized one of the voices. Tanius. Terius was speaking with the Regency Council.
No, I think we can settle this now, Narime said.
She pushed ahead. Surprisingly, Terius's champion didn't object. Fius did, but he was too slow to stop Narime. The nearby maids yelped in surprise as Narime yanked open the door to the room that Narime was in. Once the door was open, the angry voice of Duke Ilmarn erupted from the room. Terius sat in front of a table, bottles of wine in front of him. An active wireless sat in the corner, projecting the voice of Ilmarn. Terius's expression was thunderous. He looked up at Narime in fury. His eyes quickly shot over to Fius, whose face went white as a sheet.
Tanius, would you mind explaining why your idiot bastion is in my manor?
Terius boomed. The wireless fell silent. There was no response from Tanius, who was presumably part of this encrypted conversation. Narime glanced back at Fius. He stared at the wall, face impassive. Lucia had vanished.
Tanius?
Terius asked again.
Fine. Then you answer, Bastion Fius.
Why do you dare enter my territory?
Fias remained silent. Narime took pity on him and answered on his behalf.
He says he's here to arrest me on behalf of the Regency Council.
Tereus's eyes nearly burst from his head. He knocked aside the wine glass on the table, and it exploded into 1,000 shards when it hit the wall. Red wine dripped down the wall and onto the carpet.
I'll be dead before I let this idiot act with my authority, Tereus said. I'm certain most regents feel the same way. Nobody is arresting anybody. Tanius, what is the meaning of this?
Fias took a step toward Tereus. In response, the horse girl champion drew her weapon. She stepped between Fias and her regent.
Not another step, heretic, the horse girl muttered.
Fias backed away, hands up. Finally, Tanius spoke up.
You cannot deny that Narime's actions have put the Federation in danger, Tereus.
Do not put this on others, Tanius, Tereus said.
A moment later, Ilmarn joined in.
If anybody put us in danger, it was your fucking stupid plan to attack the Empire to begin with.
Tereus turned back to Narime and gestured for her to leave. His face was consumed by fury. Narime knew not to push her luck any further. By the time she closed the door, Fias had already fled. The maids tittered and muttered to one another, giving Narime surreptitious glances.
Do you still want to wait? The horse girl champion asked.
She wasn't smiling, but her face practically glowed.
Lead the way.
The room that the horse girl led Narime to was a small receiving room. Once inside, the other champion shifted uneasily for several moments. Feeling uncertain, Narime tried to make some small talk.
I would have thought it unwise to call Fias a heretic. That's the Empire's position.
The horse girl shrugged.
He is one, isn't he? The goddess is judging us for what he and High Lord Tanius did, and for what they continue to do. The cascade was a warning.
Is that how the people of the Federation saw this?
The Empire is almost here anyway, the horse girl continued. Liberation is coming. It's only a matter of time before we are free.
She giggled.
I can't believe that might actually be true. Freedom.
Then the horse girl gripped Narime in a tight hug before fleeing the room.
Liberation? Freedom?
Narime was left with only the company of the maids when they brought her refreshments. And her thoughts. Narime always had her thoughts. Right now, they considered whether the Beastkin welcomed the Empire's arrival. Would the collapse of the Federation be a good thing for them? Or was it only wishful thinking on their behalf, particularly because Nathan was leading the attack? Eventually, Tereus finished his meeting and joined Narime. His mood had improved, but he was still sour. He walked with a slight stagger and chose to drink tea instead of alcohol.
He's gone, I assume, Tereus asked.
Your champion scared him away, Narime said. About her.
You don't need to warn me about her. The Beastkin situation is something we are well aware of, Tereus interrupted. It's completely ruined all our contingency plans.
It has.
When the Nationalists in the Empire started rising in power years ago, we began formulating plans to protect the Federation, Tereus explained. The defensive pacts with the Spires and Arcadia were the latest iteration of those plans. Now that the Spires are in turmoil and Arcadia refuses to help us, while heresy hangs over Tanius's head, we need to use older plans.
Which involve Beastkin, Narime said.
They have to. Most of our champions are tied up in the east, defending the border with the Hakim Desert, Tereus said. If the Empire invaded, the plan was to recruit more Beastkin champions.
We'd also mass-recruit Beastkin soldiers and use their increased natural strength to our advantage.
They're slaves. Why would they fight?
Because the Empire would be led by somebody like Bastion Tarban, who hates Beastkin and would give them no hope of a better future.
Tereus chuckled.
But somehow, it's his son who is leading the assault, and the Beastkin love him. His most famous champion is a cat Beastkin. Seraph's been sowing tales about her all winter.
Hence the talk of liberation. Nathan was a savior for the Beastkin. Narime wondered if he knew what Seraph had been up to.
Then why is your bodyguard a duo gem champion who hates you?
Narime asked.
She drew her sword to protect me. That's good enough.
Tereus sighed and drained his teacup before pouring more.
I don't blame her. Unlike the other champions, she gets along with the maids. She's earned both of her gems. Whatever happens, she deserves to be